KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in False Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Akutan, Alaska.
This is KAEB 91.9 on your FM dial. Your one-stop shop in Sandpoint from classic oldies to banging new modern.
Hey to all you fish enthusiasts out there. Whether you're an avid angler or just curious about fish, we'd like to welcome you to Fish of the Week, your audio almanac of all the fish. Monday, February 3rd, 2025, and we're on a week-by-week tour of fish across the country with guests from all walks of life. I'm Katrina Liebeck with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Alaska, and my co-host is Guy Uro.
And this week, we're going to be talking about bronzebacks, the original Micropterus, and the gamest fish that swims. That's right, we're finally doing smallmouth bass, and in fact, the whole smallmouth bass species complex.
And I'm very happy to introduce our guest, Andrew Taylor. He's an assistant professor at the University of North Georgia. So very warm welcome to you.
Thank you, Guy and Katrina, for having me on. I'm a big fan of the Fish of the Week podcast, so this is really
awesome.
Fun.
Awesome. Okay, well, this is really perfect timing to get your perspective. Just got some feedback from a fan on Instagram suggesting we give some more love to the black basses and sunfishes. So with that said, it sounds like there's some recent forward momentum understanding kind of the complexity of smallmouths and the diversity there. So I'd be curious if you could just start us off real simple with what a species complex is and then who's in that complex.
That's a great first question. There has been increasing work, increasing interest in the black bass genus. So this is the genus Micropterus. It's one of the genera of sunfish in the family Centrarchidae. They're top predators of a lot of the ecosystems they inhabit. You would think, being as important of a sport fish as they are, they support like a $1 billion industry. We would know pretty much everything there is to know about them by now, surely. But we're still finding a lot of new things about them taxonomically. A lot of this work goes back to counting scales on the sides of fish. Turns out counting scales could tell you a lot about this group of fish.
Awesome.
And a lot of the insights from back in the 1940s are now coming under a new illumination with genetics methods. And so a species complex is sort of this idea where you might have several closely related species that share a common ancestor. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're the same in appearance. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're the same ecologically, evolutionarily. They could be headed in different trajectories. But it just means that we can tie them back to a single ancestor in time. So when we talk about the smallmouth bass species complex, we're talking about the gamest fish that swims, as Guy alluded to in the intro. So the OG smallmouth bass is Micropterus dolomieu, and that's what we've all called smallmouth bass and known about them for a long time. They were described in the 1800s, but potentially three other members, one that we've known about since the 1940s, which we're calling the Neosho bass. So Micropterus velox, and velox means swift.
Okay.
That was given by Hubbs and Bailey when they elevated Neosho smallmouth bass to a subspecies. For the very first time, they gave it a name. It was a subspecies name. Its body is built sort of streamlined for living in these quick, fast-moving, spring-fed streams of the Ozarks. And so as we got a better understanding of just how genetically different they are, we were just like, well, they should just be Micropterus velox. They are a species level different. And then two that have come to light more recently with molecular work, one called the Ouachita bass and another called the Little River bass. The Ouachita bass and the Little River bass do not have formal species descriptions that accompany them at this time. They are just known based on coarse morphological description and then paired with lots of genetics and genomics work.
Right on.
Okay. Thank you.
You know, I do want to take us a step back here. You know, we call them smallmouth bass, and granted, you talked about how big a fishery there is for them in the United States, so I'm guessing most people who listen to this show have a decent idea of what a smallmouth bass looks like. But for someone who's maybe not from the U.S. listening to this show, smallmouth might be a deceptive name. Can you give us a description of what this fish actually look like?
They are pretty well camouflaged into their environment. One of the common names you hear most anglers refer to them as bronzebacks. So they sort of have that bronzy, dark brownish hue. And then sometimes they have various expression of these like tiger stripe almost blotches on their sides, fading into sort of a gray or whitish underbelly. And yes, we do call them smallmouth bass, but a relative term, right? Because their distant cousin is Larry the largemouth bass. And Larry the largemouth bass has a huge mouth gate, right? It's still got a big mouth. It can still eat a lot of other fish, crayfish, and vertebrates, but it's smaller than Larry the largemouth. That's how they got their name, smallmouth. Their appearance can vary quite a bit depending on where you are. Honestly, I think what initially tipped off the early morphological investigations into this group was especially in the Ozarks, sort of the central interior highlands region of the United States. These things look a good bit different. They look more yellowish and their blotch patterns look a little more rounded than vertical bars that you would see in maybe like in the Great Lakes with a traditional smallmouth bass. And so I think that kind of drew people to be like, wait, are these smallmouth too or are they something different?
Are you able to tell the difference if you had a Ouachita or a Little River or Neosho or traditional smallmouth? Like, if you looked at them, could you be able to be like, okay, that's a Neosho?
That's a great question. I'm still learning. So in my study of bass, I've worked with a bunch of the different species and closely related species, and you definitely have to develop an eye for some of them. Some of them are very easy to tell apart, and some of them are a little more nuanced. I feel pretty convinced I can tell apart a Neosho bass from a smallmouth bass, but granted, I've spent almost 10 years working with them, taking genetic samples from them, linking those genetic results back to pictures of them, and fine-tuning like what it is that I'm looking for, and it's kind of hard to convey that to others. People who fish for them, they'll be like, yep, I know what a Neosho bass looks like. Having them explain it back to me or having me explain it back to them, it gets tricky. With the Ouachita bass and the Little River bass, to me, visually, there are some striking differences. For example, in the Little River bass, some of the populations that I've sampled and genotyped have really bright oranges in their anal fins and sometimes in their caudal fin and in their paired fins. And I'm not sure that that occurs in other lineages of smallmouth, but I think that's still kind of what we don't know and why maybe these things haven't been described yet, is we don't really know visually and morphologically how they're different, if they're different enough. Because this whole concept of like what's a species is kind of a messy one with the bass world, because all the bass can kind of interbreed with each other.
It's complicated.
I suspect that after thorough investigation, we'll probably see that there are some morphological differences and some pigmentation differences.
Guy, what you got in your background?
I like this line of questioning because it allows me to put Andrew on the spot real quick, because Andrew and I go back a little bit and I see him at like Southeastern Fishers Council meetings and stuff. It seems like every year, because I did in 2019, I tried to catch all the black basses. And then it's like, oh, in 2020, there's another one. 2021, there's another one. So every time I'm passing these central highlands, I have to pull over into a new drainage and catch a new bass to make sure that my list is complete, which that's not a problem. But I did want to take this opportunity to ask Andrew, do you know which one that is in my background?
Oh, my goodness.
To be fair, it's a 25% chance if you take a shot in the dark.
Let's see. Well, you know, Guy, it's a little smaller than the ones I'm used to holding. Just kidding.
Burn.
If I had to guess, I would guess it's a Neosho. I see sort of these hollow, more rounded blotches down the middle of the body, and I see some yellow in the fins. It kind of also looks like a Little River bass.
It is a Little River bass. That was actually out of cucumber.
Ding, ding, ding.
I could believe it. And yeah. See, that's why it's so tricky. There's a similar group of bass that kind of have the same issue, and that's the red-eye bass species complex. It got split from one species into...
Well, there's seven now? Oh, wait, maybe it's six. What? Coosa, Cahaba, Warriorensis, Chattahoochee, Tallapoosa. I'm forgetting Tallapoosa. And then you got the Bartrams, Altamaha. Yeah. So there is seven now.
Yeah. In that situation, they all share a common ancestor, so we call them a species complex. There are things you can use to identify a red-eye bass, like it has sort of this blue crescent of like eye shadow over the back of its eye and white margins on some of the fins, but all of them kind of have that. And so a lot of the anglers in that area, pretty much you just go by the basin that you're in, and you kind of know just based on where you are geographically what this critter should be. And when those were described, they did find some subtle differences and things you could count and things you could visually tell pigmentation wise but to the average angler, if you showed them a picture, it would be really hard to diagnose them back to what species they belong to.
I thought I was getting pretty good at the end. I think I could do just about all of them except Bartrams and Altamaha. I don't think I could tell the difference between those two. Sorry, Katrina, you're trying to...
I want him to try to identify my fish in my background.
Oh,
granted,
goodness.
I just got it offline, so I got it off the roughfish.com website right before this call, so I think it's correct. But
that one has a much wider belly, a much wider ventral side, and yellow in the fins. And then I would have to guess it's either a kind of a washed-out Neosho bass or it's a very washed-out smallmouth bass.
It's a Neosho.
Nice.
Good job. All right.
You're pretty good. You know your stuff. I trust you on this, Andrew.
You know, it's really tough, though, because we don't really have a set of descriptions that say, like, here's the two or three things you can look at to tell these apart. And the black basses in general, different groups have publish these descriptions at different times, and they don't all look at the same characteristics. They don't all use the same approaches, and even some of the really old ones that we accept weren't necessarily all held to this level of rigor, which I think is kind of the ultimate litmus test, is can an average angler hold these in their hand and know what they've got.
So you think that diagnosability by a layperson is kind of essential to something being a species?
With sport fish, I think it's pretty important, especially with the bass, because people like to move these bass around. And so you can't really use geographic location to be sure of what you've got. And so on one hand, from a conservation standpoint, you know, we can use genetics and we use molecular techniques to tell these things apart, to find pockets of diversity that we should conserve. But if you're going to regulate a fishery, if you're gonna say, well, you can harvest these but you can't harvest those, these are non-native, these are native, that sort of stuff, you have to be able to tell them apart. As much as I would love it, we can't arm every angler with a genetic vial and have them do tissue clips.
Insta-PCR streamside.
Yeah.
I would normally ask this question more towards the end, but I think it's important to kind of put up front for folks to think about as we get into maybe some of the challenges of management and all those things. But why should people care about this diversity over the landscape?
That's a great question. I definitely come from the viewpoint of, we should know what diversity we have out there in our fisheries, and we should try our best to conserve that diversity. Diversity of life on Earth is sort of like hierarchical, right? And we kind of have that with the way we talk about and organize life on Earth. We have domains, kingdom, phylums, all that, all the way down to species, and then some groups go into subspecies, and we kind of have to know where the big differences are. Because let's be real, there's a limited amount of resources out there kind of stuff, right? And so we need to know where those highest level, most important differences are within a group of fish so that we can designate those as the things that we should try to retain. And for smallmouth bass complex, since they all did evolve from a common ancestor, who's more inclined to lump things together could say, well, yeah, but they're all smallmouth. And someone who's inclined to split things apart could say, yeah, but there's four evolutionary lineages headed on different trajectories, right? Yeah. There's truth to both of those perspectives, but I think the value in recognizing them as independent entities is that some of our research shows that they all diverged from a common ancestor about 1.5 million years ago.
Long time
ago. And they now inhabit very isolated pockets. And the only gene flow they have between each other anymore is human-facilitated gene flow, which is, in my opinion, very artificial, right? And so really the idea is that each of these lineages could harbor their own unique adaptive responses to their current environments that's been shaped over millennia. And these adaptive traits could be really important as we move into the future, particularly with this group. Because if you look at the bass, the black basses in general, a lot of them tolerate pretty warm water.
Mm-hmm.
And the smallmouth bass has always been kind of singled out as, but this one's kind of a cool water fish. It likes colder, more oxygenated water. And that's true for this whole group. And if you look at where these little pockets of interesting diversity, they're in southwest Missouri, northeast Oklahoma, northwest Arkansas, well, and into central Arkansas. It's the very, very southern and western edge of everything we call smallmouth. So it's hotter there, it's drier there. And in some of the streams, it gets very, very hot in the summer. Some of those streams actually stop flowing in the summer, yet smallmouth persist. What we call smallmouth as a big group persist there. I would venture, I wouldn't encourage anyone to try this experiment, but I would venture that you could take a northern smallmouth bass from somewhere else in their range, put them there, and they might keel over really quick.
Yeah.
So when you think about potential effects of climate change, more intense droughts, more prolonged droughts, maybe keeping these things around could save what we know as smallmouth bass fisheries.
Yeah, people love fishing for them. That's a great point.
And we don't really know those adaptive value questions yet. There are molecular methods and experimental approaches that can get at some of that, but they have not been done on this group. You would think that we would have a lot of research on these fish comparable to maybe like trout and salmon.
Yeah.
But we don't.
That's so interesting because it is so popular.
Yeah, we don't have that same level of interest in this group. I think there's a broad, widely shared perspective that since Larry the largemouth can live in a ditch in the middle of the city, very tolerant of habitat degradation, that we should focus all of our money on things that we perceive to be more vulnerable. And certainly with climate change, you know, trout or cold water fish, that's where we should be focusing our efforts. But I do think it's a bit of a disservice to the group as a whole.
Yeah.
To consider them all, you know, very robust and very able to tolerate a lot of humans' negligence, because we do have a handful of species that their conservation long term is very much in jeopardy.
The northern smallmouth, or whatever you want to call it, Micropterus dalimu, has been introduced all across the country as well. So you also got to talk about it as an invasive species in other places too. It's fun going down to Georgia. You know, brook trout are often brought up as the example of this fish that in its native range needs to be conserved, but then you go out west and it's a real nuisance species. But smallmouth bass is another great example of that. And you see issues in the Snake River, for instance, and it affecting native species. And most recently, in like the upper stretches of the Grand Canyon, in those couple years where we had these droughts, because you mentioned, you know, they're a kind of cooler water fish. They're not a cold water fish. And so you had this thermocline in Lake Powell, and eventually that got down below the turbines. Smallmouth came through, and now they're potentially threatening native and endemic species in the Grand Canyon and the Colorado River. But we do need to consider these special populations, which I am a little bit curious. You know, you're down in Georgia. How did you get involved with these fish several states away? What drove your interest in these?
Oh, that's a good question. I grew up in Northwest Georgia, and the area I lived in had lots of little lakes and ponds that were kind of public access. My dad was really into the outdoors, and luckily he took me under his, you know,
Finn.
Guidance. I was his little fisherman buddy, and I think I was fishing by the time I was like 3 or 4 years old, and just loved it ever since. Really what got me into the black bass world, though, was I was kind of already in the right place geographically, but it still took some serendipity. I had two things happen within really close succession. So when I was in high school, I had a biology teacher that really inspired me, but he gave us an assignment, and it was something along the lines of find 3 species that live in our area, but nowhere else. Even the internet was kind of new back then. He had said that he had given this assignment many, many times over, and everybody finds the same 3 or 4 species from like an internet search. But I came back with like these really obscure fish, like the red-eye bass and the Etowah darter. And he was like, Andrew, where did you find this stuff? And I was like, I don't know. I like fish. He was like, you could study fish for a living. And I was like, oh, okay.
What?
That's awesome. And then right around that same time, I had a neighbor that grew up fishing kind of out of the city in rivers and streams. And he was like, you've really got to come with us and float this creek. And I was like, what do you guys catch? Are you catching trout? And he was like, no, we're catching bass and sunfish and all kinds of cool stuff. You really need to come. And I caught a red-eye bass that I had just done that report on. And I was just like, this fish is like the most beautiful bass I've ever seen in my life. At that point, I was like, anything I can do to learn more about bass, I'm going to do it. And then I've just gotten really lucky to associate with a lot of really great researchers and just kind of been at the right place at the right time. So I've worked on the Red-Eye Bass Complex at University of Georgia. And then I went to get my PhD at Oklahoma State, and that kind of connected over to like, well, what are the local bass in Oklahoma? It's mostly going to be largemouth and it's mostly going to be spotted bass. But yeah, if you get over towards the Ozarks, there's these really nice crystal clear streams that have smallmouth. And I was like, okay, I got to learn everything there is to know about these, and went down the rabbit hole of, oh yeah, there's actually the Neosho subspecies. What's going on with that? And I remember the first time I caught one, I was with one of my good friends, and we had both just caught a couple of them, and we're just like, these things definitely don't look like the smallmouth bass that we have in North Georgia and Tennessee. They just look very different. And that just piqued my curiosity even more to try to just position myself to answer these sorts of questions.
What are your longer term plans to continue to pick away at those questions? And I'll steal Guy's question that he likes to ask sometimes. If you had unlimited funds or resources, how would you structure that plan to answer all the unanswered questions about this complex?
Oh my goodness, that's a great question. My first instinct is we have to get a good understanding of how we would prioritize our conservation right off the start. And I think a lot of that is just, well, it's a lot of molecular surveys with high coverage. So instead of like, okay, we only have this small pool of money, let's get a few fish from each of the really big rivers. Let's actually do longitudinal sampling of the rivers, their tributaries, try to cover it all and find, first off, where the populations are different, because they could hold unique adaptive properties.
Yeah.
But then also we're picking up things like, where are these populations that are native being hybridized with non-native things? And part of the kind of wonky history in that part of the world is, since we called them all smallmouth bass and we thought that they were all one thing, we moved them across their boundaries willy-nilly for a couple hundred years now. And in some places, it seems like the non-natives, for whatever reason, they didn't take. But in other areas, they've not only taken, they've nearly completely replaced what was there historically.
That's too bad.
So I would say that's my first priority, is just a big, broad scale, but also fine scale conservation genetic status of these critters. We're trying to do it, but I would want to do it even bigger and better.
Yeah.
And then I would want to know more about their unique ecologies, and I would want to know more about their adaptive significance. Let's map a genome. Let's line up these genetic differences to actual genes and figure out what their functions are. Are some more heat tolerant? Is that genetic based or is that behavior based? Those would be kind of my two top priorities. And then a third would be more human dimensions related, which is why I'm kind of glad I'm on this podcast too. We're still trying to figure out what these things are and how they're important as scientists. My worry is, you guys know this, science takes sometimes a long time, and we put hypotheses out there and then we realize, oh, this one needs revising and so on and so forth for many years to fine tune things. But meanwhile, on the ground, there are populations of Neosho bass that in the last 20 years or so have nearly gone off the face of the earth.
Oh man.
And so it's kind of like there has to be some human dimensions component to get people to be aware of the unique things that they have in their drainages and their backyards, that we don't lose them before we even fully appreciate what we have.
Totally. That sounds awesome. I hope you can do that.
I hope so too.
Kind of related. So back in 2015, I know there's a big symposium on black basses. A lot of good research was published out of that. And now 2025, Black Bass 2025 is coming about. It's going to be down in San Antonio. It's kind of like an all-star weekend for all the people in Micropterist research and conservation and management, and I'm anticipating you'll be there. What are you looking forward to in learning that week, and who are some of the other big players? What's the big news in terms of black basses?
Oh my goodness. Yes, well, first off, I'll say I am insanely excited about Black Bass 2025. As someone who studies them, and I would study them until my last breath, this is like going to your favorite rock band's concert. I'm like, oh my God, is so-and-so going to be there? And it's almost kind of like a reunion too. You get to meet so many of the people that do the science. It's good to catch up with them. We kind of feed off each other's energy sometimes and help build each other up and help each other get good work done. There's so much good work going on in the black bass world right now. From a taxonomy standpoint, we have a few undescribed species, and I know there's different labs working on getting the formal descriptions and putting names to these things so that it's easier for state agencies and management agencies to justify resources to conserve them and manage them. Quite frankly, part of the reason I like to go to these conferences is sometimes you don't know who all's doing what. And most of the time, the very best research you see at these conferences are being done by grad students that have only had 1 or 2 years working on something very, very intensively, and they poured their heart and soul into it. I think that's also like makes a really healthy community that we can all share each other's stories and not be super territorial, because that happens a lot in science too, where people are like, oh, this is my fish. Don't come anywhere near my fish. And I think that's kind of unhealthy, because you want diverse perspectives and people collecting independent data sets. And, you know, if they come to the same conclusions someone else came to, then you feel even better about that conclusion. But if not, then you have to go back to the drawing board. And there's great work being done all across for black bass diversity. Most of it's centered in the southeastern U.S. So from, say, like Texas all the way over to Florida and then kind of up into Tennessee and the Carolinas. Not to be like it's an exclusive club or anything, but that's kind of where most of the species lie. And all the state agencies have started to really embrace, like, we have to figure out which of these critters are in our waters and how they're doing and how we're going to manage them. Several of the states have black bass slams now, which is super cool. I know Guy's gone on his black bass odyssey.
Yeah. And, thanks again for letting me use that figure in that write-up. I truly awesome. Appreciated that, even though it's no longer up to date.
Well, you
thanks
know,
to I, Andrew's continued work.
You know, Guy, I even kind of shot myself in the foot, because I had almost all the species caught hook and line. And then when we did the Kim et al. 2022 paper and realized that the Little River bass was probably pretty different from the Wachita bass, I actually had to go out last summer and redo my smallmouth bass slam, because I had never gotten a proper Wachita bass on hook and line. I had only ever gotten fin clips from like electrofishing surveys. Mm-hmm. But I had to go back I'm hurting myself, my own pursuits, my own hobbies.
Wachita was the hardest one for me to get. Seemed like there was tons of good habitat, and I just couldn't find them.
Yeah, so kind of to play off what you're saying, I'm not familiar with the Ozarks. I haven't been there. I haven't done the slam. If I wanted to go do that and make sure I get the Wachita, how would I go about kind of handling this slam? What would be your suggestions maybe for a newbie to this?
Oh, that's a great question. These are all kind of in a pretty small area that we call the Interior Highlands. But the geology and the habitat's quite a bit different. These fish have evolved kind of independently in pretty different habitats, even though geographically they're kind of close by. The Ozarks, where the Neosho inhabits, are mostly limestone dolomite. There's lots of springs, kind of karst landscape. Springs bubble up, clear water, smaller substrate gravelly type stuff. And the densities of Neosho bass in some of these streams are like through the roof. Growing up in North Georgia, you could come across like, I don't know, like a bathtub-sized pool in a stream, and you might get one red-eye bass or one Alabama bass out of that pool. In the Ozarks, sometimes that same size pool can have 10 Neosho bass sitting in it.
Dang.
That blew my mind. It's a totally different beast fishing out there, because the water's so clear, you really have to like have lighter tackle, thinner line. You really have to imitate. Their favorite food seems to be like small crayfish, helgramites, other small invertebrates. Most of the time I'm throwing something that kind of bumps along the bottom. There's a few really well-known streams in the Ozarks that have floating outfits where you can go and rent a canoe and or a kayak. And,
oh, cool.
But there's a lot you can just wade from a bridge access.
There is a state park in Arkansas, and I forget the name of it. It's like Devil's Cave or something like that. But it just had some gorgeous streams on it, tributaries to the Neosho. Is Neosho a river that these are named after?
Neosho is a river. It's part of the Grand River system that eventually empties into the Arkansas River. And so the native range of the Neosho bass is really, really specific. It's kind of weird. It's tributaries of the Arkansas River that flow off of the Ozarks, most of them flowing kind of east to west and then kind of north to south off the Ozarks into the Arkansas River. The Arkansas River drains like most of several states, including Oklahoma. If it's not draining off the Ozarks, you can be just on the other side of the river and fish and never see a Neosho bass. There's very stark differences in habitat. Like you're either on the uplands of the Ozarks or you're way out of their habitat.
Okay.
The Ouachita Mountains have a totally different geology as well. There's a lot more like boulders that you can really easily roll your ankle and really hurt yourself on. It feels like almost like micro bouldering, really big drop-offs. And the water there can be really clear, but it also isn't as spring fed. It's more groundwater fed, to my understanding. And so it gets a lot warmer in the summer. And my understanding too is because it doesn't have the limestone geology, it's not quite as productive. So the densities of the bass tend to be a lot lower in that region. So that's why it's not because your angling skills lack, but you can cover many, many, many sections of stream in the Ouachita Mountains and not see very many bass. The densities are very, very low. There's just not as much nutrients available in the food web in those systems.
Maybe, okay. But there's sure a lot of big green sunfish, I'll tell you that.
Ooh, nice.
Well, that's actually...
They're cool, too.
That's so funny, because when I go fishing down there, if I throw into a pool, if I catch a green sunfish first, might as well go to the next pool. Because my experience is, if the bass is there, the bass is going to bite first. And usually what would happen is, if there is a bass there, you catch a couple bass, and then you start just catching green sunfish, time to move.
Okay. That's a good tip. What about the Little River, if I then wanted to go try to get a Little River variety?
Yeah, the Little River, a really nice kind of remote river that's not dammed. And if you're from that area, you probably know almost every single river that comes off the Ozarks or comes off the Ouachita Mountains has at least one big hydroelectric dam on it. But the Glover River in Oklahoma is unimpeded. To me, it's like still a very untamed system. Cool. And that would be home to the Little River bass. Little River bass and the Ouachita bass kind of share some of the same underlying geology, but they flow off of the Ouachita Mountain uplift into different catchments. So they flow for hundreds of miles each before they join the Mississippi River. The Ouachita River is this big, wide, muddy, hot river that smallmouth or Ouachita bass don't live in once it gets down off the mountains. And same is true for the Little River bass. All those streams, including the Glover, eventually come off the uplift of the mountain and down into this like downcut, slow-moving, warm, muddy Little River that then I think goes into the Red River before eventually the Mississippi. Geographically, you start to understand how these things could have evolved independently of each other. They're sort of like these little habitats, little islands of habitat in these uplift areas where the water's a little clearer, more rocky, more oxygenated, more like what you would expect a smallmouth to be in. But then very quickly, once you come off those uplifts, they're very isolated. There's hundreds of miles of really warm, muddy, slow-moving stuff separating them now.
Yeah. As you're talking, you have such a good understanding of like the landscape. When we talk to fishermen, they tend to really know the geography. I mean, I feel like you could be a cartographer kind of describing these maps. And I think that's a neat point for people to think about as you go out and like try to get this slam or get to know fish better. You're really going to get to know the landscape and the rivers and which ones are dammed and which ones aren't. I think that's super cool. Just the observations that come along with fishing. It's not just about like hooking a fish, but like really getting to know the place where you are. So that's cool. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks, Katrina.
And then if I wanted to catch the OG, if I want to catch that one in this slam, what do I do next?
Oh my gosh, OG. Well, funny enough, like if you are in that area for the other three, you really don't have to go far to get the OG. Basically, right across the mountains, just on the other side of the Ozark Mountains. You can be in the Ozark Mountains, but outside of the Arkansas River drainage, we're talking like maybe the White River drainage, you're going to find classic smallmouth bass, Micropterus dolomieu. You know, if you wanted a really, really big one, it appears to me that there's a lot of phenotypic plasticity. There's populations that live in natural lakes. So if you go like up into like Minnesota and then up into the Great Lakes, you get these like super deep bodied footballs of fish that are just monstrosities. I mean, in the best way possible, a monstrosity in the best way possible. Oh, guy changes guy just, picture.
He's got a monstrosity. It looks like
there it is.
Yeah.
And that is what most people who are fishing, that's what they would want to catch. When they talk about fishing for smallmouth, that's the beast that they're after.
They're all beautiful, though. You don't need a big beast, but that's a very nice fish guy. Good job.
I'm glad that we've had this conversation and focusing in on this diversity down in sort of your Arkansas, Oklahoma, Missouri region. But I imagine people are going to click on this episode, especially people who might be more in the angling public and less, you know, real fish nerds like us. They'd expect to hear something more about, you know, angling for these fish in big rivers up north, in reservoirs, in lakes. So I do want to talk a little bit about that. This fish that is in my background here, that came from Green Bay, which it was really impressive seeing. I was out there with a guy who was a biologist up there. He took me on a trip. It was great. With the zebra mussels that I've got up there, the water's real clear now. You can see like 50 feet down. You can see these just big males guarding their nests. We were fishing in the springtime. And yeah, just hogs.
Guy, I've even heard that some of these anglers use drones now in those berries when the water's really clear. And you can kind of spot little spawning aggregations or pieces of structure that they're gravitating towards so that before you get your boat up too close and spook them, you can kind of make a calculated cast or two.
I'll be honest, most of the fish that I'm fishing for are these smaller fish. They're in rivers. It's a lot maybe easier to sneak up than on a lake, but I was surprised by how sophisticated the techniques were needed to catch some of these big fish up there. Like, it's like you got to use fluorocarbon. Mono, straight regular mono is not going to do it. They're going to see it. No snap swivels. I'm usually a big snap swivel guy because I like to change what I'm throwing. This guy was adamant, and he was out fishing me that day by a lot. Granted, home waters and everything, but we were doing about the same thing, but with these minor differences. He was using these soft plastic crayfish patterns, bumping them along the bottom, and it's like, no, you got to hide the knot up inside the body. No knots, no snap swivels, no nothing like that. And so these were really picky and choosy fish, and so it was a challenge to get some of these bigger ones.
Yeah, I think from a fishing standpoint, I would encourage anyone who's approaching this from only having fish for smallmouth and lakes to definitely go try fishing for them in streams, even if you're not in the region where we have all these unique lineages. Fishing for bass in streams is its own art, and even though the fish don't tend to get quite as big because they're fighting current their whole lives, in theory, they're so strong. And it seems to me it's more fun because, honestly, once I kind of figure out where they're positioning basically they're picking ambush points, right? And so they're waiting for the water to do the work for them and kind of flush food into an area where they can ambush. You can get a lot of fish caught in a day once you kind of figure out what they're keying in on. Whereas in a lake, sometimes I feel very overwhelmed. You know, you're looking for the most minute change in the underlying topography. And a lot of the lakes have really, really high fishing pressure. And so you are going down into, like, you've got to hide the knot within the soft plastic body. And I can guarantee you, like, some of the streams we fish, the fish are just, they're hungry and they're completely unpressured for the most part. There's certainly some streams that get hit pretty hard, but yeah. You can also find streams and sections of streams that you feel like you've gone back in time to, like, some of the first people who ever tied a feather and a hook to a line, and the fish are just doing outrageous things or chasing your baits all the way back to the boat, and it can be a lot of fun.
I think one of the best places to look is, I've always had success on, like, these kind of sloping points that come out off the bank. So if I'm targeting them in a reservoir or something like that, looking for rocky banks in particular, and then specifically these areas that slope off to a point, I've had success there. And then in terms of finding the right habitat in a stream, you mentioned these smaller streams, finding these pockets that are slower moving water. And I agree with that. But in larger rivers too, particularly when you get further up north, actually looking for the faster water is, I think, a good place to try and find these bass, because they do need it cooler and oxygenated, and they do have the capacity to be swimming and keep up with those higher velocities. So if you're in kind of a warm water, cool water river where the habitat is maybe marginal in some of the slack water, identifying those areas where it is faster can be a good spot to look for smallies.
Yeah, right along with that same thought process, usually where there's fast water, there's rock. Smallmouth bass love to use boulders and things like that as ambush points. If you can find really fast water, but there's a boulder sitting out in the middle, almost guaranteed there's a smallmouth sitting in the slack behind that boulder. Awesome. And it's so fun to watch them kind of come up and ambush and do their things.
Yeah. Yeah, they're kind of known for that. As we're talking about fishing, I'm wondering if you have any tips for anglers, you know, anything from handling to, I know you mentioned introductions and how that can kind of dilute this diversity, just anything at all for folks who are going out, maybe interested in exploring this, that would help them be a good ethical angler.
That's a great question and a good thing to consider. I think first and foremost is just knowing that there can be angling-related mortality, even if the fish swims off. There's been studies that show just the act of angling, the stress that entails, the handling time out of water can cause some delayed mortality, particularly with smallmouth, if we're talking about fishing in the summer, which a lot of us love to do.
I was wondering about timing. Yeah.
Yeah, the water's warmest and they're the most stressed they're going to be all year. So just keeping that, I would say minimize time out of the water as much as possible. So definitely I'm a proponent of CPR. Catch, photograph, release. This is just kind of my anecdotes as an angler, but also a little bit with, like, my biologist hat on too, is that a lot of these smaller streams, you know, it takes a long time for some of these fish to get to a good size where you would feel proud to catch them.
Yeah.
And so they're pretty valuable fish. I would say try to do most of your unhooking and finagling in a net underwater, like in a trout net, or just hold them in one hand underwater. Snap a quick picture up out of the water. Some of the most beautiful pictures I've seen of bass are honestly like in the water with the water and the sunlight glimmering on
them. Yeah. Yep.
If you can do that, and then a quick release. And the other thing I would say is bass anglers, which I am one, we kind of have a bad rap of moving fish around sort of to our own detriment. It's kind of a really complicated and sad thing. We like to catch fish in lakes. Most of the ones in the southeast are artificial lakes. We've built dams on rivers, and so we've moved some of our favorite bass into those lakes, but they weren't native to those areas. And we're continuing to see some pretty alarming things with Alabama bass, which are formerly a spotted bass, but they've been kind of elevated, and certainly they grow a lot bigger than spotted bass, and so anglers are like really excited about Alabama bass. And they've sort of jumped from where I grew up in Northwest Georgia all the way to like Virginia. And they're completely replacing native smallmouth bass populations in the Carolinas, Tennessee, Virginia. That to me is like really troubling. As a bass angler, I hate that we're also associated with the illegal act of moving them.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it's all anglers. I think it's a subset of anglers. And I don't know exactly what those motivations are. I think a lot of them are thinking about just having another fishing opportunity in their backyard closer to where they live.
Yeah. And there's probably already a cool one in their backyard that maybe they're not familiar with.
Yeah, exactly, Katrina. Thank you so much. Because that's what I wish we could convey to the average angler out there, is that likely you do have a really cool, unique bass near you. And so, yeah, you might open up a fishing magazine and see a giant smallmouth bass from Green Bay, like guy's trophy behind him. You may not have that in your backyard. That might not be natural to where you live, but you have something cool worth bragging about in your backyard.
All right. Well, thanks, Andrew. This was very, very fascinating, and I learned a lot. And you kind of think of like smallmouth bass is just, you know, I have a picture in my mind of what that is, but it sounds like this is just a lot more complex. So very cool.
Yeah. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you all so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you for the recommendation, Ethan, for doing more black basses on the show. Even though we have this one booked already, I'll give you credit for the recommendation.
Okay, well, get out there and live with, live from, discover and enjoy all the fish, and let's keep the smallmouth bass complex great. Thanks for listening to Fish of the Week. My name is Katrina Liebeck, and my co-host is Guy Arrow. Fish of the Week is a production of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Alaska Region Office of Communications. Our production partner for the series is Citizen Race Car. We honor, thank, and celebrate the whole community, individual tribes, states, our sister agencies, fish enthusiasts, scientists, and others who have elevated our understanding and love as people and professionals of all the fish.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.
This is statewide news from Alaska Public Media. I'm Ava White. The U.S. Senate has so far confirmed 8 of President Trump's cabinet picks, including Interior Secretary Doug Burgum. Burgum now assumes the informal title of Alaska's landlord because a major portion of Alaska's land is under the control of his department. One of Trump's most controversial nominations is Robert F. Kennedy Jr. for Health Secretary. At a hearing Thursday, Senator Lisa Murkowski pressed Kennedy on his support for the Indian Health Service, an often overshadowed agency within the health department. Kennedy says he plans to elevate the importance of Indigenous health.
I'm going to bring in a Native at the assistant secretary level. I'd like to get him actually designated as a assistant secretary for the first time in American history. Make sure that all of the decisions that we make in our agency are conscious of their impacts on the First Nations.
Alaska senators have so far voted to confirm all of President Trump's cabinet positions, with one exception. Murkowski voted no on Pete Hegseth for defense secretary. He was confirmed with the tie-breaking vote of the vice president. Housing shortages and overcrowding affect most of Alaska, and the North Slope is no exception. In particular, the remote region faces additional logistical challenges, but also unique economic opportunities. That was a takeaway from the North Slope Borough Housing Summit held in Anchorage last week. The event highlighted affordable ways for residents to buy or build homes in the Arctic. Jack France is the director of the Borough Housing Department. He says homes in the region are falling apart faster than new ones are being built.
You also hear about it when you have, you know, a young adult that wants to stay on the North Slope, but has to move down to one of the lower cities just because of lack of housing on the North Slope as well.
France says the country's most northern region, which is predominantly Alaska Native, is in a unique situation. The remote geography makes shipping and construction challenging and expensive. But he says residents of the oil-rich region also have interest and resources to purchase houses. He says that more than half of the North Slope homes are owned by residents. The Housing Summit aimed to connect potential home buyers to existing financing opportunities, available contractors, and affordable ways to ship supplies. For example, France says panelists discussed how residents and entities could form a co-op and order supplies together to cut shipping costs.
When you talk about economies of scale, generally, just more you order, the bigger discount you get.
The borough plans to put together a guide listing banks and contractors who are looking to work with buyers in the region. They also plan to present a report on the summit during Kivyuk, which is a celebratory midwinter festival in mid-February in Uktiagvik. This is Alaska Public Media.
The Alaska Morning News is brought to you in part by
North Rim Bank, helping power the businesses that power Alaska with customized solutions. More at northrim.com.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Workday. Workday is an AI platform for forward thinkers dedicated to transforming the way business leaders manage people and money today so they can transform tomorrow. Workday, moving business forever forward.
This is Statewide News from Alaska Public Media. I'm Ava White. Boosting education funding is a key priority for lawmakers in Juneau this year. Districts have been forced to shed staff and close schools across the state. The predominantly Democratic majorities in the House and Senate are each pushing to increase state funding for public schools. Friday morning, Republican Governor Mike Dunleavy unveiled his own bill, setting the stage for negotiations with legislative leaders. Alaska Public Media's Eric Stone has more.
Let's start with the problem. Alaska has languished near the bottom of national education rankings for years. In fact, the most recent version of the nation's report card puts the state 49th out of 50 on fourth grade reading performance. Math scores aren't much different. Dunleavy pointed to those scores at a news conference on Friday.
Is it because our kids are incapable? Is it because our teachers can't teach? I reject both of those reasons. It's because the policies that we have before us that we're contemplating are not in place now.
Those policies are outlined in a new bill Dunleavy introduced that would make a variety of changes to the way the state funds public schools. It would boost the funding districts receive for correspondence programs and transportation. It would increase funding for career and technical education programs, and it would create an incentive program rewarding school districts for students who read at grade level or demonstrate improvement.
We have a moral imperative to design systems, allocate resources, and come up with policy that's going to change this narrative for the state of Alaska.
The bill also includes two proposals that lawmakers rejected last year with a couple of tweaks. The bill would create a retention bonus program that would pay teachers up to $15,000 a year, and it would allow the state school board, or new this year, the University of Alaska, or a political subdivision like a city, to directly authorize new charter schools. It's currently up to school districts to review charter school applications, though the state board can hear appeals. The governor's proposal is in sharp contrast with the approach lawmakers are currently considering, and the biggest contrast is what's not in it, namely a boost to the biggest component of the state's funding formula, the base student allocation. Here's Senator Lukey Tobin, an Anchorage Democrat who chairs the Senate Education Committee.
We recognize that our ship is sinking in our public school system, and we need to throw it a lifeline and get them resources to address unchecked inflation. That is not included in this legislation. There is no substantial increase to the base student allocation proposed in this omnibus package.
Parents, teachers, administrators, and business leaders have given hours of testimony to House and Senate education committees in recent days, saying they're struggling to maintain even basic school programs. A large majority have cited funding as the key issue holding them back. Base per-student funding has risen just 0.5% since 2017. Sitka Independent Representative Rebecca Hinshute introduced a bill with the House's take on the education funding debate early in the legislative session. It would boost state education spending by nearly three times as much as Dunleavy's bill, more than $325 million in its first year, with larger increases in future years. Hinshute, who co-chairs the House Education Committee, says she's sympathetic to targeting funding on high-priority needs, but she says the governor's bill falls short.
That's the icing on the cake, and right now we don't have a cake.
Hinshute and Tobin each say they're hesitant to dismiss elements of the governor's bill outright. They both say they're planning to take a close look at the wide-ranging bill in the coming weeks. House Speaker Bryce Edgman calls the governor's bill a positive first step.
We are going to have a meeting of the minds, I feel, on some of the policy items. Some of the other items we may set aside and deal with separately or perhaps later on. But I think there's a willingness to also get schools badly needed funding that they are, from small to mid to large schools right now, really just sort of buckling underneath.
Lawmakers say they're planning to pass an education bill early in the session to allow districts time to write their budgets for next year. Edgman says the House is targeting mid-March. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Eric Stone.
This is Alaska Public Media.
Be a better place, and the world
Good morning, everybody out here in Southwest Alaska. Yeah, I've been here for a while, and I was hoping I'd get on the air, but all this NPR stuff was going on. I wanted to be the one that's long-winded, not them. And anyway, it's another day in paradise, and thanks for listening. I have a little bit of Merle Haggard. Take us to the top of the hour. We have Mama Tried. After that, Reasons to Quit, that's Merle and Willie. I'll be back at 10, it looks like, but here we go.
The first thing I remember knowing was a lonesome whistle blowing and a youngin's dream of growing up to ride on a freight train leaving town, not knowing where I'm bound, and no one could change my mind, but Mama tried. The one and only rebel child from a family meek and mild, my Mama seemed to know what lay in store. In spite of all my Sunday learning, towards the bad I kept on turning, till Mama couldn't hold me anymore. I turned 21 in prison, doing life without parole. No one could steer me right, but Mama tried. Mama tried, Mama tried to raise me better, but her pleading I denied. That leaves only me to blame, 'cause Mama tried. Daddy, rest his soul, left my mom a heavy load. She tried so very hard to fill his shoes, working hours without rest, wanted me to have the best. She tried to raise me right, but I refused. And I turned 21 in prison, doing life without parole. No one could steer me right, but Mama tried. Mama tried, Mama tried to raise me better, but her pleading I denied. That leaves only me to blame, 'cause Mama tried.
Sober, my old friends don't come around much anymore. Reasons to quit, the low is always lower than the high, and the reasons to quit don't outnumber all. So we keep smoking and we keep drinking, having fun and never thinking, laughing at the price tag that we pay.
To write some new songs that will rhyme.